Yesterday, we spent the session talking about racism in church and society. In the United States, all the last week for the group that was here the previous week, we spent most of the week talking about, in my sessions, about talking about the struggle for justice in South Africa. And by the way, this afternoon, just an advertisement, I'll be showing my slides on South Africa this afternoon at 4 o'clock and talking about that again if anybody's interested. And that'll be in the Village Center. As part of a kind of a series that Al Pitcher and I are doing together this week, in which I'm taking the first two and he and I are taking the third one together, and then he has Thursday and Friday, relating to the question of societal and systems changes and racism, etc., and injustice in the United States. So yesterday I spent in a brief session talking about racism in America. That to try and encapsulate that in one session is difficult, but we had an excellent discussion, I think, for those of you who were there. In a sense, this is a continuation of that, but it's a separate kind of a subject, and it's at looking at it from a totally other perspective. And what I'd like to do is to use the story of Exodus as a way of attempting to look at ourselves. Just as the racism section yesterday was an attempt to encapsulate kind of a seminar that I'm used to doing in 3 or 4 days, this thing which I'd like to present to you in about 20 minutes is sometimes, as I'll show you along the way, a game which I play with people that takes almost a whole day, and it's kind of a fun thing to relive Exodus with our identity in it. But I'd like to tell it to you because we don't have time to play it. But it has to do with, as we'll come to, and you'll discover more as we go along, I hope, with the question that I've titled this session with, and that is, can the Pharaoh be saved? That's not to be mistaken for Leo Bustad's pheromones. Can pheromones be saved? But rather, can the Pharaoh in the Exodus story be saved? To begin with, I'd just like to recall the story to you, or the early part of that story. If any of you want to follow it in the Bible, you can. It's Exodus. I'm going to use to begin with Exodus chapter 1 and chapter 5. But especially to look at it through the eyes of our own society. And when I first began to do this, it just shocked me how unoriginal we are in creating the language of oppression. It tells the story of the slavery of the Israel people almost as though it could have been recording the enslavement of black people or Native American people in the United States. It's just it's a parody almost of our language as they read it. The basic ingredients of racism being fear, and particularly the fear mixed with the myth of multiplying like rabbits, you know, the whole kind of a thing we have towards welfare people especially and towards oppressed people, that the basic problem is population explosion, if only they didn't have all those babies, and underlying that fear has to do with the whole question of our being outnumbered and they're eating up all our stuff. The antidote for the poison is to kill the babies, some sort of form of population control, and labor, and work them to death so they won't have so many babies. I don't understand the connection of that, but that's what they said in the Exodus story, and that's what's the constant myth in our own society, too. Somehow, if they worked, they wouldn't have as many babies. I don't know exactly what that comes from, but so just listen to it and listen to some of the comparable language, almost a parody of a lot of things in our own society. You remember that was that one of Leo's animals? You remember that the Israel people came as refugees to Egypt, but then as the Exodus story begins, after Joseph dies, and time goes by, and nobody knows exactly how much time, whether it's 200, 600 years, but a great deal of time goes by, And the sons of Israel were fruitful, verse 7, chapter 1, and grew in numbers greatly. They increased and grew so immensely powerful that they filled the land. And so you begin already to see them multiplying like rabbits. Then they came to power in Egypt, a new king who knew... I'm reading from the Jerusalem Bible, by the way, but if you're reading from King James, it's an interesting comparison. Then there came to power in Egypt a new king, or Pharaoh, who knew nothing of Joseph. Look, he said to his subject, these people, the sons of Israel, have become so numerous and strong that they are a threat to us. We must be prudent and take steps against their increasing any further, or if war should break out, they might add to the number of our enemies. They might take arms against us and so escape out of the country. So those who were once now refugees have become so valuable economically as a labor source for the country that they not only had to be prevented from being a threat in terms of numbers control, but they also could not be permitted to leave, to escape the country. Accordingly, they put slave drivers over the Israelites to wear them down under heavy loads. And once again, the value of labor is not only to the Egyptians, but as a means of control, to wear them down under heavy loads. In this way, they built the store cities of Pithom and Ramses for the Pharaoh. But the more they were crushed, the more they increased and spread. Just exactly the opposite of both the expectation of the expectations of oppressors all over the world and in our own day, and who somehow see the idea being reversed, that if we could control their population, it would be a means of relieving their oppression, but rather seeing as sociologists, psychologists have said over and over again that the unconscious need to multiply, to have, you know, is part of what comes out of oppression.
What was that? Unconscious need to multiply.
Sure. In oppressed people's country where death of children is five times the numbers of ours. People have, you know, the having of babies is a matter of self-preservation in times of oppression, as one aspect of it, besides just the a deeper psychological and sometimes unspoken need, at least some psychologists say, of people's seeing on their own multiplication, their own as being a response to being an oppressed, destroyed people, the creating of someone new and of a new people, totally contrary to our population control theories. Well, that's another whole thing about our population control theories, but somebody has said that it takes about 16 times the amount of energy and resources to raise a child in our culture than in the culture of those populations we're trying to control. So if we really wanted to control population, we'd put much more of an emphasis on our own. But at any rate, that in this case, and maybe in our case too, it was a matter of controlling them so that they did not become a threat to us, to the Egyptians. So the Egyptians forced the sons of Israel into slavery, made their lives unbearable with hard labor, worked with clay and with brick, all kinds of work in the field. They forced on them every kind of labor. Then the next section not only shows demonstrates the Pharaoh's population control program, but also the great survival abilities of oppressed people throughout the country, throughout the history of the world, having to do something with the fact that oppressed people end up really knowing oppressors better than the oppressors ever know the oppressed. And black people in our country talk about that all the time. You think, you know, the white people think they really know black people, and it's really the other way around, because survival has really depended upon their knowing us, and also their ability to fool us. Their ability to fool the oppressor and therefore stay alive, a survival tactic, and what's called in our in black culture shucking and jiving. And here we really get a chance to be able to see the Israel people shucking and jiving the Pharaoh. The king of Egypt, in his population control program, then spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shifra and the other Puah. "When you midwives attend Hebrew women," he said, "watch the two stones carefully. If it is a boy, kill him. If a girl, let her live." But the midwives were God-fearing. They disobeyed the command of the king of Egypt and let the boys live. So the king of Egypt summoned the midwives. why he asked them, have you done this and spared the boys? And here comes the, you know, the story of the shucking and jiving. So the Hebrew women, they answered, the Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women, they answered the Pharaoh. They are hardy, and they give birth to the midwives before, they give birth before the midwives reaches them. And so the Pharaoh believed it. And God was kind to the midwives, and the people went on increasing and grew very powerful. Since the midwives reverenced God, he granted them descendants. Okay, then the story goes on to tell in the next couple of chapters about the birth of Moses, another very comparable situation to our own, the growing up of Moses to have an Egyptian consciousness, the revolutionary thing that happened to him when he rediscovered his Hebrew consciousness, very comparable to the whole black consciousness movement and black power movement here in the United States, as well as that which is taking place in South Africa right now, the failure, the wrong direction of having chosen in the first place, and then its failure of saying the means of doing something for these people is to give them our identity, and the revolutionary thing of discovering who they really were. And then in chapter 5, when Moses returns home after being called by God, remember he had to go into exile because he got into a fight with one of the guards and killed him. After he had discovered something of his consciousness, own consciousness, or that was part of the process of his consciousness raising. And then God calls him back to be the lead the liberation struggle. And as soon as he begins to organize the Hebrew people, the Pharaoh gets angry, and so he comes back to the old oppressor's tactic of how to control the people, is to call them lazy, idle people, and to try and stop them by increasing their work, and once again making their work useless. At first it was a useful labor, at least to the Egyptians. It was not useful to the laborers themselves. And it's one of the marks of oppression, not that you don't have work to do, but that the work you do is for the oppressor and not for your own self. If you look in most of the clothes that you're wearing and I'm wearing, that there's some oppression involved in the fact that it's being made in a cheap way for us by the Koreans and the Taiwanese and the Hong Kong people or the Brazilians, that the systems that provide that work, usually the corporations say, if we weren't there, we would not be giving them work. That's partly true, but only partly, because the work is not being done for their own sake. They are not building up their own people with their labor. Their labor is being used for our sake and not for their own, and therefore even that is a mark of oppression. Just as the work of the Israelite people was done for the betterment of the Pharaoh, for the Egyptian people, not for their own selves. Well, Pharaoh goes another step, and he makes it even useless to him, his own self, as a means of punishment and control. And he, remember the straw law. He takes the straw out of their bricks to make it harder for them to make their bricks as a means of punishment and a means of control, the labor organizing that Moses is doing. Pharaoh gave this command to the people's slave drivers and their overseers. Up to the present, you have provided these people with straw for brick making. Do so no longer. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. All the same, you are to get them from them the same number of bricks as before, not reducing it at all. They are lazy, and that is why their cry is, let us go and offer sacrifice to God. The total irrational connection. The reason they want to go worship God is because they're lazy and they don't want to work.
May I raise a question about your quick conclusion? American factories in Taiwan, does it give them a chance to enjoy the fruit of their labor? It's providing means wherewith they have better support for themselves, even to the degree there is one Lutheran church in Hong Kong now that has enough people employed so that they're going to establish centers for working among Chinese in this country, and they're able to support it without getting any money from mission boards or anyone else. This is a very complicated thing, and it could, it seems to me, also be looked upon as a way wherein there is a distribution, not a voluntary distribution, matter of fact, but we're having to share with them because American corporations can make more profit out of having it made over there.
We spent a lot of time talking about that last week, and I'm certainly willing to talk again some more, because I think it's a very, very important question. I believe that there are a lot of isolated good stories to tell. I think that the basic documentation is in that the theory of people's development through our investing, our profit-making, on a trickle-down theory of our profit-making in corporations, in providing cheap labor for the producing of our goods of an over-consuming, overdeveloped country, is not working. The development is not taking place. That even the highest examples of Brazil, where the largest gross national product of for over a decade of any other country in the world, still has not only reduced the gap between the rich and the poor, but has increased the gap between the rich and the poor. Or South Africa, where 20% profit is being made, even higher than most places. I believe, after doing a lot of studying, I think the conclusions are in that means of development is not taking place, and that what's being demonstrated over and over again that a system of overconsumption and a system of overdevelopment, where a high percentage, 50%, up to 50% of the world's natural resources are being used for less than 10% of the world's population, that what's really happening is a system that's not breaking down of requiring poverty and requiring cheap labor, so people to you using and their cheap labor to supply our needs rather than their own, even though some of their survival needs are being met. That the growth and control of their own resources and their own development is not taking place. Now, there's dispute about that. There is dispute about that. I believe that for me, that it's more and more becoming evident that is the case.
Joe, I don't know if you're going to be talking about this later on, but I'm getting an analogy between this Pharaoh oppressing the Israelites and forcing them to work. I can see pretty easily the analogy between South Africa and the white government forcing. In my own very limited knowledge, I at this point can't see the analogy between our government forcing the blacks to work. Is there one? If so, will you get into it later?
One of the primary means that even though South Africa has tremendously repressive laws of controlling anybody who opposes their system, they do not have laws that require black people work for white people. There are no laws that require that. Every black person who comes from the homelands, where they're required to be if they don't have jobs, to work either in the mines or as servants in Johannesburg or any other place, does it of his or her own free will by signing a contract. That does not mean, though, they're not required. They're required by an economic law. The creating of the kind of economic conditions in which they have no choice. That's the only choice they have in how to use their labor, even to the point of raising the taxes in the homeland such that so that it is not possible to be self-sustaining on their own, but to be dependent upon the cheap labor contracts in the industry in Johannesburg, or as servants in Johannesburg, in order to require by an economic system of laws, even though there is no political law requiring it, that they do that. I believe that, as I mentioned in talking about South Africa, that looking at South Africa is in many ways looking at an exaggerated caricature of us, like the distorted mirror you see in a fun house. You know it's you, but it's sort of blown up and looks fat. That the economic laws in our country and in our countries, or our Western world's relationship to much of the rest of the world, has the same kind, maybe not to the intensity in all cases, but often the same kind of result.
Paying taxes in the homelands. In the two homelands that they freed, do they still owe taxes to the South African government?
the economic relations are set up of an even more devastating one, in that that country's independence is related to an economic relationship of aid and support for the government, so that the migrant labor system is sustained. That's why they're set up that way.
Aid and support which way?
For of South African government to keep that false child, that so-called independent country alive, of an economic exploitation. Well, that's a very brief answer to that. I believe that it's a fair comparison. I believe we're discovering more and more, or at least I believe we are really encouraged by the faith to look at the kind of means of exploitation and look at our, and be free to examine our economic system and to see whether it is doing that. And to not call any economic system as holy, or economic processes as holy.
The laws in our country now on the matter of racism forbid any organization existing that would not allow black people to be members.
I beg your pardon?
I say, do the laws on racism, I haven't kept up with the are they such, just as you cannot discriminate against a black person in employment, preventing them from joining organizations that they might qualify for?
Private organizations are still permitted to be, if they have no economic relationship or dependency to the nation, to national laws. But
well, then, do you know whether or not academic honor societies, of which there are many, and it was true not more than 20 years ago that blacks were not permitted to belong in the very rules of the academy, where one would have expected different points of view. It's not many years ago that the Minneapolis Athletic Club would not allow blacks.
If you'd like to talk about that separately or later in the lecture, I think I'd like to continue on with this. But I'd like to tell you briefly about this game I sometimes play with people and some of the things that happen in it, and then draw a couple of conclusions and still have time for discussion. What I think is really important for us to do in discovering the will of God for us and the ways we can work for change in our society is, first of all, to re-examine a lot of things about our own identity, who we are, and how change comes about. And there's no magic answers to that in the book of Exodus, or even any magic answers to that in the Bible. But I think that some reflection in the story of Exodus is really important and helpful, especially since people who are struggling for liberation as Christians around the world, and especially those who are developing so-called liberation theology, also use the book of Exodus as a very important starting point. Exodus and Easter, the liberation in the story of Exodus and the liberation that comes in the resurrection as important learning points for working for justice. And I think it's also important for us to do the same. So one of the things I do is when I'm working with a group, is to sometimes to start off by telling the story of Exodus about as far as I went now with this group, and then to ask them to take a few moments, talk with each other if they need to, but just take a few moments and to take their identity, to take your identity, your name, your address, your telephone number, your profession, your family life, your family situation, and project it back into that story, and to give yourself a comparable identity in that story to the identity you have today. To without making any great changes, but to, and it's sort of a fun thing to do if you have a lot of time to do it, to just sort of create an identity back in that story that's comparable to the one you have today. And then when we have time, we just let people go around introducing themselves, you know, and the identity they've given themselves. What usually comes down as an important decision for people to make once they've told their story is that half of them have introduced themselves as Egyptians, and half of them have introduced themselves as Israelites. And we usually probably spend another hour just letting that struggle go on. Are you going to be Israelites? Are you going to be Egyptians? Do you? And generally, after a long time of struggle, people believe that in the Exodus story, if we're going to be honest with who we are in our lives today, we have to give ourselves Egyptian identities. We have to come out to being the people of Pharaoh. Now, a lot of people have trouble with this, especially the more theologically trained among us have trouble with this. Usually it's the ones who've been to seminary who hold out to the end of being Israelites. Because, as out of our Christian tradition, we have such an important relationship of being spiritual cousins of the Hebrew people. Their liberation is our liberation. Their going through the Red Sea is our going through the Red Sea, and so forth. And their wandering in the wilderness is our wandering in the wilderness. Their coming to the land of milk and honey is a prototype of our coming into the kingdom of heaven, and so forth. And that the faith is a fulfillment of the Israel history for Christians is an important image. The problem with that is that it leaves that struggle in the Exodus story that we're referring to today as a spiritual liberation. And the Jewish people throughout history, as well as those who are looking at this story from the point of view of liberation struggles today, say that this story cannot be understood, even its spiritual implications, unless you first of all take into serious consideration, first of all, that it is a story of political, economic liberation. It is a story of a people enslaved, struggling for a political liberation from a literal political oppressor. At least in the context of people coming together and trying to study this story and learning what our struggle for justice and social change is about in the world today, most people that I've worked with, after struggling with it for a while, end up saying that from looking at it from a whole community point of view and not denying our spiritual relationship to the Hebrew people, that projecting ourselves back into the story, we've got to give ourselves an Egyptian identity and to understand the nature of that struggle as it took place from the point of view of the people of Pharaoh. And it's also just a lot of fun to talk about all of the implications of that. For example, Egypt was not just an evil oppressor. Egypt was one of the most advanced technological civilizations with lots of good things about it in that day. In many ways also very, very comparable to our society in relationship to the rest of the society around it, so that it's not just simply saying we're only oppressors. Also trying to say that, as we were talking about in terms of racism yesterday, that when one begins to struggle with our identity as racist people, either as a racist society, as individuals, or as institutions which act in a racist manner, we're not talking about somehow you are guilty and you are going to be condemned, you must be destroyed in the Red Sea or any place else, but rather that we live in a system that oppresses us as much as it oppresses black people, that imprisons us as a being a racist people, and that when one talks about you or I being part of a racist system, if we haven't already taken the guilt about that to the altar of God's forgiveness and being forgiven, we ought to do that, you know, stop right now and do it, because that's where Christians do with their guilt, get forgiven, and then say, okay, now how do we deal with our racism, now that it's not a matter of guilt and condemnation, but rather how do we now see ourselves as set free to combat the racism that imprisons us. And so also in the context of understanding the Pharaoh in the, and we'll come to that in more detail in just a second, but in understanding the Pharaoh and the people of Egypt in the relationship to Israel, to see them as a people who are as any person who is an oppressor or who acts or who lives a life in such a manner that somebody else suffers because of the way that person lives a life, then both persons require the liberation. Both persons need to be set free. Both persons are broken people coming out of a broken society who need both to be reconciled to a system that sets them both free. If I have a gun on Al and say, you must do what I do, then both of us are imprisoned, him to my gun and me to my gun, in terms of maintaining my lifestyle. And that liberation must understand that both of us are oppressed. Well, it's also fun to talk about, especially that this period of history in Egypt was a time of a brief life of a strong monotheism in Egypt. So one can also carry the imagery of sort of the American religion, which is far from Christianity most of the time. That civil religion we have that sometimes is very hard to separate from our Christian faith. As being not too far from what might have been taking place in Egypt too, and I've created a kind of a fun thing called the First Church of Ramses II, with of which I give myself an identity of being a priest in, and as programs of develop programs of charity for the Hebrew people, and to helping legislation to take care of the Hebrew problem. And programs of desegregation of the Egyptian schools and so forth, adoption program for Hebrew children, and so forth that can be carried on in that kind of imagery. I wish we had chance to play. It's really a fun game. At any rate, after that's after we've done that, there's a second part to the game, that is for people then to take one more thing back into their identity, which now. The people generally agree that it's an Egyptian identity. If there's any holdouts, they can be what they want to be, but we don't try and make anybody into anybody. But to take that Egyptian identity and to take one thing more back into that Exodus story from your present day life, and that is the way you work for change, the way you're involved in trying to bring about change in our society, and to project it back into that story. And as an Egyptian working for change, and I forgot to say this about identity, is that I leave plenty of room, and I think the story leaves plenty of room for Egyptian people who wanted liberation for the Hebrew people. There were a bunch of liberal advisors to the Pharaoh, who at first just said, "Well, send them out to the desert for a little while. They'll then bring them back, and they'll be satisfied." It's sort of like when there were riots in Chicago when Dr. King was there, or before or after that time when Sarah and Al Pitcher were working there a lot, and I was working there part of the time also, and whenever there was a riot in Chicago or any other city, as a matter of fact, except that Mayor Daley was better at it than anybody else, he'd bring all the ministers together and say, "What can we do to cool them down?" And so they'd put sprinklers on the fire hydrants or something to cool them down, to pacify them. And they were the liberals doing that, the people who really wanted justice for the black people. It wasn't, but rather everybody agreed if we got to cool them down so that we can solve their problem for them. And that kind of thing we get caught up to. And so you take that kind of, there were those kinds of people in the Egyptian story. And when they reach chapter 10, about verse 7 or 8 or something like that, or 9, those liberals have sort of changed their mind. But now they're not just saying, do something nice to pacifying them. They're really in favor of Hebrew liberation, but for their own self-interest's sake, they're saying, for God's sake, let them go because they're going to ruin us. it's Egypt that is going to be ruined after all those plagues. All right, if you take the way you work for change in this society and project it back into that story, and then create a lot of images, and it's just been fun over the last couple of years to play this game with people and have them do some of these things I was telling you about, like charity programs for the Hebrew people and desegregation of the schools and NAAHP and all kinds of things that can have to that all of them, however, almost all of them having to face the fact of how, in the end, how change came about in this story, and the effect that all of those efforts for change really had on the change, that the change came about in a in a totally different way than the people expected, or in a totally different way than they were working for, and achieved a totally different ends than another example of that is the way in which it's good to see the South African picture as an image, a distorted image of ourselves again. The liberal South African whites who are opposed to apartheid generally look for reform within the existing system because of their own economic investments in it, and do not really look for total one man, one vote. Do not look for or place their hope in majority rule and the faithful, and placing faith and hope in the leadership of black people, of the majority population. And so that projecting ourselves back into this story oftentimes puts the ways we work for change into that old criticism of how do we solve their problem for them, and especially how do we solve their problem for them so that they can have justice, but so that we also do not lose our privilege, so that we also maintain the power position in society. Well, I can go on with this. I've developed also a skit that I sometimes, sort of a one-person skit that I haven't done it in a long time. Even if we had time, I'd probably be too embarrassed to do it. But it has to do with a report of a pastor to a home congregation of his attendance, of a priest rather, of attending the annual convention of the First Church of Ramses II, and down by the at a very lush resort down by the Nile, and it's during the time just at the end of the convention that the Exodus takes place, and the news of the Exodus taking place, and the whole convention is about them passing, about them reporting on their social services to the Hebrew people, of the whether it's food and blankets and crisis and all the kind of social. Of social services and housing programs and so forth for the Hebrew people, all of which are good then and now, and then reporting, and then having the large debates in the convention about their influence of the Pharaoh and the national system, about having reforms for them, and one of them is a program in which they finally get the convention to go a close vote, but a majority vote in favor of recommending to Pharaoh that they put the straw back into the Hebrew's bricks, and then they have another debate, but the liberals lose, in an attempt to condemn the Pharaoh's program of birth control, but they do create an amendment which creates a committee for studying the morality of the methodology used. Anyway, and then they have Aaron, golden mouth Aaron, who's Moses' mouthpiece, come in and be the banquet speaker, at the and it's a comparable thing to the mid-60s when we always had angry black people in to give us our speeches and make us feel guilty. Remember those days, and to lay a heavy black rap on us. And so Aaron comes in and he's so skilled in doing that, and really does a call for justice and an end of charity. And then the convention gives evidence of having been totally swayed by him, but at the same time totally misunderstanding what he said, and that they vote their willingness to be a reconciling force between the Pharaoh and Moses, and vote nothing about the changes of the causes of the causes of the brokenness, but only that and the total misunderstanding of reconciliation. And then it's right at that moment, just as they vote that in total misunderstanding of it, they get the word that the march has begun towards the Red Sea. And anyway, that's someday I want to start redoing that as a skit. All right. One other thing, and then we can talk. And that is the ultimate point that I think for us in this story, or not the ultimate point, but one of the important concluding points in this story, I think for us, that is often missed, and whether or not you agree with the analysis I've projected into this story of Exodus, I think that this is an important conclusion out of it that we often miss. And that is the question of the liberation of the Pharaoh. We really get caught often into that trap of the of those who were talking with Jesus, and Jesus got so mad at him, he said, "I came for the sick, not for the healthy. Stop trying to pose as healthy people." You know, and so we can see how it's really easy concept for understanding that God wants the Hebrews to be saved, you know, but that the Pharaoh is to be saved, offered salvation. Or it's easy for us to think about, you know, what is it going to take to liberate the black people of South Africa? But the image, you know, that it's the image of wondering whether the white South Africans can be saved. At any rate, it's especially important to us, I think, if to whatever degree, at least, that we have that identification with Pharaoh, that we ask this question in the story. Over and over again in the Exodus story, and I think this is an extremely important point, over and over again in the story, I think my count is right, that out of 13 times when God says why they have to go through all this trouble, you know, he could have just let them out. Could have just, you know, just some other way to do it. It was 10 plagues and all that trouble. 6 out of the 13 times, the answer comes out as it does in chapter 7, in the beginning of chapter 7. And it's really sort of a schizophrenic thing, because he also says he wants to harden Pharaoh's heart all the time too. But he says, I lost it.
Verse 3.
No, the other part where he says he's doing it in order Pharaoh can know the glory, the Egyptian people may know the glory of God. Yeah, verse 5. And all the Egyptians shall come to know that I am Yahweh when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring out the sons of Israel from their midst. Over and over again, there is this kind of statement which in the King James says that Pharaoh may know the glory of God. Now, I don't think it's reading too much into that story, at least from the point of view of a post-Christian era, of saying that to know the glory of God has some connection with that Pharaoh may also be liberated, that there may be some kind of a knowledge in there of who is God. Now, the other side of that is, of course, the Red Sea and the hardening of the heart, and Elmer Witt did a good treatment of that last week, or the week before last, in which he had been reading C.S. Lewis's Walt Bowman had been reading C.S. Lewis's Great Divorce, and wondered why one person couldn't be saved who was just a grumbler, you know, hasn't been all that sinful, just a grumbler. And the answer that the person from heaven who's visiting and talking about this at the edge of heaven is that because the person had become a grumbler grumbler for so long that there was nothing left, the person had become a grumble. And there was and there's some kind of a sense of whether or not Pharaoh reached a point, whether there's anything there that was salvageable in that culture, in that society, or whether or not they had become an oppressor and nothing else. And that there was nothing left but hardness of arteries and hearts, and nothing left but that which could be drowned in a Red Sea. I don't know, but I think that one of the things that's quite clear in the Exodus story, and one of the things that's quite clear in our own day, and very clear as any explanation of human condition, that if I am an oppressor of Al, then the first condition for Al's freedom is that I stop oppressing him. He's got a lot to do with his own human condition and development of developing into be a free person. But the first condition of his liberation is that I stop oppressing him. The first condition of my liberation is that I stop oppressing him. that the stopping of the oppression is a necessary condition for both of us becoming free persons. That oppression must therefore once again be, as I said in the beginning, be understood as that which enslaves the oppressor as well as the oppressed. Or Martin, as I said yesterday, that Martin Luther King and many others have said over and over again, that when the black people get free, that it will be the white people who also get their freedom in the process. That when women become free, it will be men who learn to be liberated persons in the process, etc. And you can apply that to any stage of liberation in terms of the relationship of the oppressor and the oppressed. Well, I've been playing this game with people for a long time. I've got a long list of responses of people and the kind of identities they give themselves, and I've got a lot of other things I could go on talking about it, but I want to leave some time now for some responses to that within the context of what you've heard, what you agree with, what you disagree with, and what you can add, whatever.
You've been playing around with this, trying to raise the question of giving identity not only between us and the situation in Exodus, but between us and the situation in the Middle East right now. Because there are, an awful lot of Americans that make it difficult because they identify immediately with the Jews. And almost feel that it's a God-given responsibility to do that.
No, I haven't. I really try and do this primarily within the context of the kind of studies that will help me deal with our own identity. I think it'd be fun to do that. I'd really like to see some Jewish people do that.
How do you go back for with the analogy as far as the sources of this oppression, speaking about which to me is a little oppressive? In the Egyptian situation, it seemed to me you were saying that the new Pharaoh, who had had no contact with Joseph or the relationship that Joseph had had with the Egyptian pharaohs before, was in a sense neurotic and worried about perhaps the stability of his own future with the presence of all of these people, which he never had a very special relationship with. Is it opening too big a can of worms to wonder what's your opinion of the sources of oppression on our half of the analogy is?
I'm not sure what you meant by that. The sources of oppression in our half of the analogy.
We speak of oppression, but you haven't spoken of the sources of oppression in the case of we, the collective we, with the black people, or with the Indians. Is it your opinion that there are some specific sources of oppression, or is that just too global a topic?
Can you give me some examples of what that might be, so I can make sure I'm hearing you?
I'm not sure that... we talked about the fact of oppression and how it's demonstrated itself, but I don't understand why the oppression exists. I don't understand the sources for the oppression. In our case, I can appreciate the way you interpreted the biblical situation in the Israel-Egyptian situation, but I'm not sure I understand the source of oppression in my own.
I think you made the analogy of fear, which seems to me is...
Is that the kind of thing you're talking
about? They're going to take over type of mentality.
Is that the kind of thing you're... Are you talking about the kind of thing that would be begun at least to be dealt with in terms of talking about human nature and greed of people who, when they get power, and it power getting out of control?
Well, yeah, this sounds like what I'm curious about, yes.
Is that...
What is the American identity as far as where the sources of oppression are coming from?
Lois.
Can I take a slide of that as a
sure.
child development person who's interested in child development? You know, when Joe talks about these things, about the way nations are starting, when I read the news, it just looks to me like the same thing that I see in the block corner in the daycare center in the nursery school. You know, here is somebody who wants something and somebody else whose rights are being trampled on. And I see children who can handle that and who can compromise, and I see children who have to fight for that. And it seems to me like the whole primary source of this whole thing is this thing I mentioned last hour, the pecking order sort of thing. And I don't know how we can ever get rid of that, but I think we really need to think about it in the way we raise children in our society. We are a highly competitive society. We think of this in terms of our economics, that this is the way to go. We think of it in our families. We have our children competing with one another. I'm not sure that sibling rivalry is a normal, natural thing at all. I think we raise children in the spirit of competition very often, and that's because we need to compete because we were raised that way. That old thing I mentioned last hour about, you know, the sins of the fathers visit upon the children. It's a power struggle. The way we raise children, this comes from the way we see power. If we're able to share power with our children and say to them, I expect you to control yourself, I don't need to be in control of you, I need to be responsible for you, but that's different than being in control of you. You know, then we raise a child who is able to cooperate and who doesn't feel competitive and doesn't feel threatened by people that can do things better than they are and doesn't need to fight with peers or other people for a share of power. If we can't share power with children, we raise kids who have to push other people down. I mean, that's the opposite experience. People, you know, cop out and hand the child all the power. Overwhelming and raises
anybody else want to put something into that? Is that the way your question was aiming towards? Is that the kind of thing? All right, let's push that a little bit. Where do you see forces in our society which put us in some sort of an imprisoning mold that that keeps us from being the free people that we'd like ourselves to be and the freeing people we'd like to see ourselves being?
Well, I think there's tremendous pressure for quote success in terms of title, position in employment, all the things that success implies in our society. There's tremendous pressure from it's maybe internally I feel it in terms of classmates that I've had in college who are vice presidents of insurance companies and who are, I don't know, doing all kinds of other stuff. And I've been at home doing 9 years. What have you been doing there?
The what? I'm sorry?
They ask what
you
do at
home, you know, what have you been doing at home village? You've been there 9 years.
I see. Oh, yeah.
So, dear, whatever I've been doing. You know, am I success? I think I am, but I don't know.
Yeah.
But there really is that. There is a pressure there. It's subtle. It's self-imposed, but it comes from outside you.
Duffy?
Kind of responding to that, kind of just responding to the whole question, I think I see a lot of the roots of oppression, at least in the West, to be in American religion and in American theology, the oppression of American theology. We propose a religion that's built on success. We interpret the gospel of Jesus or the whole commission of Jesus to be to change people to think like us. We build kind of a merit-oriented system that's based on believing all the right things about Jesus or acting the right way. And in order to do those things, you have to have some kind of criteria by which to climb the ladder, you know, and being spiritual. And to do that, you have to have somebody on the bottom of the ladder.
Somehow, another thing that comes through both, also so religious as well as the kind of things that Lois was talking about of educational or the television, or is a definition of success and being and humanity in terms of having rather than being. You know, it's just an incredible way we get used insofar as we believe that or are suckers to that belief. How much we are used by other forces in society so long as we can be bought with things. I'd like to test out one other thing and to have tried testing out so many things in this in 1 hour is probably kind of stupid, but it seems to me there's another conclusion that comes from this, whether or not you fully agree with our identity in the Exodus story being Pharaoh, but even out of our conversation that we've just been having, as well as in that story itself, that not only are we enslaved or imprisoned in a system that depends upon the hurting of others in order for it to exist, but even if it didn't hurt others, which is hurting us because of it's not allowing us to be fulfilled as, in at least in the image of Christians, as Christians we see what it means to be human, of making us individualistic and not community oriented, of making us competitive achievers rather than cooperators, of making us havers rather than beers. That all of those things which define what our concept means of what it means to be community of the renewed and re-enlivened people of God, the values of those things in our society which compete against that and which destroy that and enslave us and our children into other kind of things. So that the thing I want to test about that is that as a kind of thing that always just frightens me every time I think about it, that liberation for us is the painful process of the same painful process that the Hebrew people attempted to put Moses through, the Pharaoh through, the painful process of losing those things, of losing the ability to build a society on those values. As much as we can agree academically that those values for a society and for being people are not the right ones, look at how much of our daily life is built upon having them. And if justice in the world, if for the underdeveloped and underprivileged, depends upon our not being able to be overdeveloped and overprivileged, is it a valid prayer? Even though it's expressing willingness to go through the painfulness of withdrawal from the drugs, to pray that God will, what John Schramm says sometimes, to pray to be pruned. Is it a valid prayer to ask that these be, that we not be not permitted to have them?
Maybe that's what the Lord's doing with us through the inflation.
Maybe prayer is being already answered before we've even learned to pray it.
I think it's very important, Joe. I sometimes object to the word oppression because it suggests somehow if other people had power, if you shared your power, somehow let them participate in the system, that you would solve the problem. And I think what you're saying is it wouldn't. As if all we did was make everybody equal to the being or the having of the oppressors, it's a matter of the substance of our life,
right,
not simply the power.
Yes.
But that, I take it, is one thing we're going to get into tomorrow, is various interpretations of what's at stake or why.
Yeah, okay. I hope that's a whole enough day, hour, for those who can't come back tomorrow, but for those who can come back tomorrow to pick up on that, of what it means to pray.
pray and work for change within the context of that kind of a concept of who we are and what it means for us to be human, to also pray and ask the question about what kind of forces can make that happen to us without driving us to the Red Sea. Because there's a little button and a whole series of little buttons that represent for us the Red Sea of the Pharaoh. The very last minute, after 10 plagues, he finally said, all right, let him go. And then he woke up in the morning after they had all assembled and started heading out for the Red Sea. He said, my God, what have I done? There will be nobody left to serve us. That's what he said. Economic system of dependence upon other people's suffering.
Well, that
pulls my shirt tail a little bit, and I think it really needed to be pulled, though, because that statement made it so dramatic as though it was just dependent on the Israelites. It was a large slaving tradition, and I, from what I understand, the Egyptians replaced them with other slaves, you know, ultimately. But that was, and that's part of a longer history between Egypt and Africa rather than Egypt and Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And the King Tut displays and other Egyptian kind of things show an awful lot of that kind of African influence on Egypt, and Egypt as a part of Africa in that relationship. And the Red Sea, how many got drowned compared to what we could do with our buttons, I don't know either. But that how far are we as a people willing to go in our enslavement to being an overdeveloped people and an over-consuming people, how far are we willing to go to preserve them? Or what are we willing to do to keep from being stopped? I believe that what Fred said, I believe we are being changed. I believe the forces are already in motion that are forcing us to change. And I think the question is, how do we respond to those forces, not how do we convince our people we should voluntarily change? I think we are being pruned. How do we creatively deal with that? Or at least, how do we prevent ourselves from going to the Red Sea?
Well, how do we accept it as a gift? Because I really
how do we accept it as
a gift?
Yeah, the gift of liberation.
It will really open up life all over for us.
In many ways, it's very exciting. It's a challenge to see if you can work with your budget or whatever it is that's being pruned and come up with something that's even better. I know many times we've found that we were in a crunch situation, that if we really sit down and think about it and brainstorm and pray, that we come up with something that's far better than we would have had if we hadn't been forced to challenge, and it's cheaper and easier.
Maybe we need the
Well, let's pick that up tomorrow. The question is on two levels. The kind of level you just said, it means a transformation, a willingness to see that as a gift that transforms our personal lifestyles, but it also, along with that, in a companion way, asks the questions, how much are we willing to have transformed of the whole West's way of structuring itself systemically, economically, politically, in order that it doesn't, my personal lifestyle might change, but that there's something more than that in terms of a larger system that perpetuates what we're trying to change.